Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of this podcast with Damian, and we have a very special segment for you guys today. As many of you know, it is November 3rd, Election Day here in the United States of America, and we're having a live stream with a lot of esteemed guests on our podcast. Number one is going to be Simon Anholt, who's on with us right now. Simon is a foreign policy expert. There we go. I put up the little sign. He has a lot of experience, you know, advising people from across the world, talking about what makes up a good country, and is really, really influential in you know, determining policy. So to kind of explain who he is and what he does, we have Simon here today. If you want to kind of explain that to our listeners, Simon.
You want me to explain what I do?
Absolutely.
How long have you got?
go ahead. As long as you need.
Okay, well, I'll give you the short version. I have spent the last 20 years advising the presidents and prime ministers of 58, 59 different countries around the world. Not the United States, in case anybody was wondering. It's not one of the countries that's ever asked for my advice. Maybe it doesn't need it. what I normally advise on is what I call international engagement. In other words, helping these countries figure out how they can engage most productively and most collaboratively with the international community, how they can make the best of the community of nations. And I do a small number of projects on the side, some of which are designed to be a little bit provocative. There's one which is very relevant today, which is called the Global Vote. And this is a platform which lets anybody anywhere in the world vote in the elections of other people's countries. Obviously, they're not real votes. They obviously don't really sway the election, but they do enable people to have their say. And the reasoning behind that is, I think, quite important. We live in a very interconnected, very interdependent world. Anything that goes on in one country sooner or later is going to impact people or planet elsewhere outside that country. And so I thought it would be kind of interesting to find out how people would vote, say, for the US president if they weren't American, or how would people in the US vote for the next president of Botswana if they had the choice. So we're running a poll at the moment, which is open to everybody in the world, including Americans, to pick the next US president. We've got a large number of votes from well over 100 countries. I'm going to be closing the poll in about 4 hours time, and then we'll publish the results on the website and see how the world voted in terms of the next US president. What else? I also published something called the Good Country Index. Varun, you were mentioning that before. This is a much more serious piece of work which attempts to measure how much each country on earth contributes to the world outside its own borders. So there are dozens of surveys and indexes out there which measure how well countries perform domestically. But until the Good Country Index, there was nothing that measured what their impact was on the rest of the system. So if you do good stuff that helps other people and other places around the planet, you go up in the ranking. If you do things that harm people or places outside your own border, you go down in the ranking. So, and a bunch of other stuff. I've just published a book.
Yeah.
Can I show you my book?
Yeah, absolutely. There you go.
Oh,
the
wow.
Good Country Equation. Oh, there it is. Okay. It's called The Good Country Equation.
Yep.
And that tells the whole story of what a good country is and why we need more good countries.
So here we have a little glimpse of your website. They can't see the full thing because we have a little bit cropped out. But if you guys want to check that out, go to goodcountry.org. Just some amazing stuff there. And we've had some very unique guests on the podcast. If I don't say so myself, I got to get used to looking into the camera. We don't usually do a live stream. But we've had some very unique guests on the podcast before. But I don't think anyone as unique as you. What caused you to kind of go down this career path? Was there a moment that you can like look back to that you were like, this is what I want to do? Or was it just some circumstances that just added up and aligned?
It was a series of accidents, to tell you the honest truth. I mean, what I studied at university was nothing to do with what I do today. I studied medieval French literature, if you can believe that, amongst other things. And then I went into advertising, mainly because my dad told me not to, and I became a copywriter. And then I got very interested in the international side, because I've always had an interest in foreign countries and foreign cultures. I ended up traveling around the world, looking at how we were managing our international campaigns. That was fascinating. And then I suddenly decided that countries were more interesting than companies. So I basically lied. I told everybody I was the world's leading expert on country image. And because there were no other experts on country image, I guess it became true.
Wow.
And I started writing essays about it. And soon enough, countries started calling me and saying, can you share this world famous expertise with us? And I kind of made it up until it became true.
That's amazing. You know, we talk about speaking things into existence, and that's an amazing story. Now, I wanted to ask you, you know, you talked about how you traveled around the world and just did stuff with a lot of countries. And I wanted to ask you, what's your most interesting experience that you've had doing so? You know, because go ahead.
It's part of the reason I wrote this book, because every time I go on a trip and I come back, people say, what happened? And I tell them these barely credible stories about the things that have happened. And people kept on saying to me, you've got to write a book about this. So in the end, I decided I would write a dual purpose book. On the one hand, it's my traveler's tales. It's an adventure story about how I got locked in a palace lavatory in Bhutan, how I tried and failed to pour soup into the lap of Vladimir Putin at dinner one night, and stuff of this sort. But on the other hand, it's also it also tells the story of how country by country, I start to form a view of what's really gone wrong with the world and why it really doesn't work and what we could do to make it work a little bit better in the future. So it's kind of an interesting book. It's half a crazy adventure story, which makes it fun to read. It's not like a textbook. Most books on international relations and politics are literally unreadable. I can't get past the first chapter. So I thought if this was more like an adventure story with characters and places and color and descriptions, I mean, half the time I'm talking about how much I hate flying, which has got really nothing to do with the problems we're facing in the world today, but it is what I'm mainly thinking about when I'm traveling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that makes it, especially for our audience, obviously, we're teenagers, we're, you know, we have politine here. I think that makes it something engaging, and it sparks like a conversation in youth, and it makes them read a book that they might have never read. And while it's this adventure book, at the end of the day, it is talking about, you know, the country's relations with each other and how we can boost those. Man, it's just, what was the experience like writing the book for you? Was it, you know, because we've never experienced anything that big in terms of literature. We did our project on you, and I think that's usually what it's like. But what is it writing that book? What is it like remembering all these different events that you've kind of gone through?
The way you describe it, you make it sound like a big task. But in reality, when I was doing it, it didn't feel like a huge task. And it's for a number of reasons. It's partly because in terms of the anecdotes, they're just so memorable. I mean, how could I forget what happened to me? You know?
Yeah.
And I'd also taken down some notes. A lot of the rest of it, the theory stuff, you know, it's stuff that I've been repeating every day 1,000 times, writing in articles, repeating in interviews, doing TED Talks and stuff like that. So by the time you come to sit down and write it all, you're not in front of a blank sheet of paper at all. You've got a whole bunch of stuff that you already know off by heart. I think the whole book took me 6 weeks to write. It's really surprising how when you're writing about a subject that you know well, and especially if it's about you and your work and you love it, it's so easy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Really is.
Yeah, and I read about some of your literary works. One thing I read was on The Guardian, your article titled "Is Trump Tarnishing the American Brand?" back in 2016. So I think I read it a couple of days ago preparing for this interview, and I was very, very intrigued by what you wrote that day. And I wanted to ask you, how much has America's reputation on a global scale changed since that day in 2016? And I mean, were your predictions correct?
I'm afraid they were. One of the surveys I produce every year is called the Nation Brands Index, and it basically measures the brand images of countries, how popular they are. It's an opinion poll. We have a panel of about 20,000 people around the planet, and every year we ask them a series of very, very detailed questions about their perceptions of 50 countries. And that's a sample that represents about 70% of the world's population. And so it gives a very, very good indication of how admired countries are. Traditionally, typically, the USA has always been number one, apart from one or two periods where, for example, the second term of George W. Bush, the invasion of Iraq, America was somewhat unpopular. It went down to about sixth place. But typically, its natural position is first, most admired country on earth. That's what America was designed to be. It was designed to be the shining city on the hill. And it's now dropped to 10th place. And it's just been kind of in free fall. And part of the reason for this is actually President Trump's rhetoric about international affairs. When he talks about America first, well, sure, there's nothing very surprising about that. I mean, if you're elected to run a country, of course you put the interests of that country first. That's really rather obvious. But the implication that he wants everybody else to come last, and he talks about other countries as shitholes, and he criticizes the international institutions. He threatens to withdraw from the World Health Organization in the middle of a pandemic. This makes people around the world really, really anxious, because for centuries we've relied on the US as being the guarantor of the international order, of international peace and stability. When you've got the guy in charge basically waving a wrecking ball around, it makes the world incredibly nervous. And that's the reason why the US is just dropping and dropping in the polls. We'll see what happens after today. I mean, if it should so happen that the other guy gets in, it'll be interesting to see how quickly the US recovers, because there's certainly an enormous amount of goodwill out there, people willing America to get back to normal again and play a role, a principled role in the international community.
So you do believe that with the election of Joe Biden, that America will start rising back up in the ranks?
I think it's inevitable, because even though most people out there know very little about Joe Biden, they don't know whether he's going to be a good or a bad president, but they know that he stands for the traditional multilateral values that people have gotten used to with America in the past. I mean, you know, we mustn't forget that most of the international order, so much of global peace and stability depends on today, was designed and underwritten by America. Mm-hmm. So having the most powerful nation that's responsible for so many of these institutions that work really well. I mean, the United Nations, for heaven's sake, it has its problems, but we'd be really stuck without it.
Right.
To have the founding country just sort of pulling out from underneath these and actually attacking them is, as I said before, it's pretty scary.
Absolutely. You know, one of your quotes in the Guardian article I was reading was, "In today's world, greatness comes from leading, not from winning." And that was really, really inspirational for me, because looking forward to the next 4 years, it's going to be an uphill battle. And I think that we have to emphasize the fact that we have to lead the world into this fight against COVID-19, this fight against climate change, these existential threats to our our prosperous nation and our lives. So I think that my question to you is, how do we build back our reputation as a nation in the next 4 years or past that? Because right now, as you said, we are on a downhill trend. So what does it take for us as the United States to come back up to our former position under, for say, President Obama, Clinton, W. Bush's first term? What does it take for us?
To tell you the truth, Varun, I think I've got two things to say about that. First of all, it may not be very difficult, because America has only been behaving out of character for one presidential term. The world has not forgotten what America should be, traditionally, most of the time has been, and was designed to be. So the world is willing America to go back to behaving itself again in a collaborative and principled way. That's what everybody wants. So they're helping. They're not sitting there saying, okay, prove to us that you're a good country, that we should feel glad that you exist. They want America to be a good country, and they want to feel glad that America exists. So I think the task is not as difficult as it would be for a country like, I don't know, Russia, for example, which also suffers from quite a strongly negative image at the moment. For Russia to try and earn itself a better image would be incredibly difficult, because there's no recollection in people's minds of Russia having been anything other than a vague threat on the horizon. The other thing I would say in response to that is, if you work for the American government, you came to me and asked me that question, what can we do to rebuild our image? I would say, don't even think about your image. You know, people as well as countries who worry about their image come over as kind of sad losers. You know, it's like the guy who puts on a new suit and goes around saying, do I look good in this? You know, it doesn't inspire confidence. And I think that the next US government, whichever it is, has got an enormous amount of work on its hands just to get things working properly. And if it's also worrying about its image, then it's going to be distracted.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I don't think that a lot of people put into perspective what it means to be a good country. Obviously, in the 60s, during the Cold War, we had this kind of domino theory, right? Where when one country starts going towards communism, then the countries in that area will follow. Well, right now, we're actually looking at trends as we become more isolationist. Other countries are leaning towards countries like China and Russia, and they're becoming more dependent on them for things like trade, especially with the, you know, the trade wars that we have going on with these countries. So what would you say is the number one factor? Obviously, when the president of the United States, President Trump, talks about, you know, America first, America being the best. It seems like he almost neglects the fact that to be the best, you must also be the best on the global scale. What are the impacts of being isolationist? What are the impacts of being lower ranked?
It's a strategy that is, it doesn't even produce short-term interest anymore. I mean, the United States has a large enough economy to be able to survive in an isolationist mode for longer than most. Frankly, it's not very long. America depends on the forces of globalization as much as every other country does. And if you don't work with the international community and you ignore the realities of climate change and pollution and all of the other things that are going on, there's no future. So it's self-interest, pure and simple. And I guess one of the things that I'm trying to prove in my book is that actually behaving in a more collaborative and cooperative way with the international community is not something you do because it's the right thing to do. You don't do it because it's moral. You don't do it because you feel sorry for people in poor countries. You do it because it's in your direct, immediate, economic, short-term interest to do it. All of the research that I've done shows that the countries that collaborate most with other countries are the ones that grow fastest. The ones that achieve most in this interconnected world that we live in today. So President Trump's isolationism, his withdrawal from the international system, is actually economic suicide. It is very, very bad for America's image. And America, with a weak image, cannot trade. It won't get tourists. It won't get talented migrants. It won't get investment. It won't be able to sell its products at a premium anymore. The worse America's image gets, the harder America is going to find it to make money. And that's just the simple economic reality. But you asked me, Damien, at the beginning of your question about the definition of a good country. It's actually very simple. Mm-hmm. For me, a good country is a country that successfully balances its domestic and its international obligations. In other words, it's a country that does the right thing for its own people. It also does not do any harm to people in other countries or to the planet. That's all it is. And that's the gold standard for good governance in the 21st century. Can you harmonize your domestic and your international responsibilities? Can you make policies that are good for your own people and for everybody else? And I've been a policy advisor for 20 years. I know it's possible. Coming up with policies that do that is really not difficult at all. You just have to be a little bit more imaginative, a little bit more innovative. And don't just always think about your own people exclusively. Think about both. And you'll probably find you end up serving your own people even better.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that your dual mandate is quite interesting. The fact that, you know, you say that not each leader is not just responsible for their own slice of territory, but also for every square inch of the Earth's surface and the atmosphere above it. I think it's extremely relevant, but also it reminds me historically of the shift between the divine, you know, authority for kings and monarchs to, you know, consent of the people. And I think that this is going to be the next step towards having a worldwide stance on the issues, because as you said before, leaders' actions don't just affect their country, they affect the environment. They affect pandemics, they affect the economy of the world. I think that one of the conceptions, the misconceptions, I should say, that many people that I've talked to have is that if a country commits itself to global objectives, they run the risk of not kind of addressing domestic issues. And I think that what you said there kind of covers the fact that global objectives are also domestic objectives in that they have a direct relation to it. So I wanted to ask you, in the spirit of just talking about, go ahead.
No, I was just confirming what you were saying, that there really is no distinction anymore between domestic and global. What you do at home produces impacts abroad. What goes on abroad produces impacts at home. So this idea that you can separate the two. I get particularly cross when people say, yeah, that's all very well about good countries, but only rich countries can afford to do that. Well, to be honest, that's the reason we're in such a mess today, because people have for decades and centuries been saying a country has to reach a certain level of economic development, security, stability, organization, before it can start worrying about the rest of the system. And that's the reason we're in such a mess today, because by definition, no country ever believes that it's rich enough. You're never rich enough. And so you carry on accumulating more and more wealth and more peace and more stability, and you carry on ignoring the rest of the planet and you know, occasionally throw a handful of coins at some desperately poor country. That doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You can do them both at the same time. And the fact that Kenya, for example, came in at the top 30 in the first good country index back in 2014 is very elegant proof of this. Kenya is a country with a very small economy, but it was one of the top 30 countries in terms of its contribution to the international community and to the world at large. So it's not about how much money you've got. It's not about how much you spend. It's about how willing you are to cooperate and collaborate and to understand the benefits that accrue to you when you do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's very kind of a really good message to countries across the world. You know, Americans, our next generation of voters, next generation of global leaders that we have here today. But I wanted to ask you one thing on that same note. Speaking of global cooperation and interaction on issues, what is the most pressing issue that to you deserves a global kind of initiative to handle? You know, we have a lot of existential threats to our existence today, but what do you think is the most pressing of these issues?
I think it's got to be education, Varun, because I have a very simple view about all of this. Every single one of the challenges that we're facing today, the challenges which are represented by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, whether it's climate change, whether it's pandemics, whether it's migration, all of those issues, there are 30 or 40 of these huge challenges. They have one thing in common. Every single one of them is caused by the behavior of human beings, right? And what causes the behavior of human beings? The way they're brought up. It's what they've been taught or what they haven't been taught when they were kids. And so it's not just about fixing one challenge. It's not even about picking the most significant one. It's about fixing them all. If we want to fix the world, we have to fix humanity. There's only one way to fix humanity, and that's by having a global agreement on what are the fundamental values that we want all of our children to learn wherever they grow up.
Yeah.
That's why your generation is so incredibly important here, because you're the ones who started to show that if you do teach kids about climate change, and you do teach them about tolerance, and you do teach them about living together and stuff like that, the generations get better and better and better and better. You guys are the best generation we've ever had. And that's partly your credit, but it's also partly the credit of the educational systems around the world. Greta Thunberg, the Swedish climate change activist, she is the product of the fact that Swedish schools teach climate change. And of course, she leaves school and she runs towards those challenges instead of running away from them, which is what my generation have done. So what I'm arguing at the moment, this is a project I'm running called The Good Generation. Basically, what I'm arguing is that we need to have right now a big global conversation where everybody in the world participates and we agree what are the basic fundamental values or virtues or principles or skill sets that we agree the next generation of children must be taught everywhere in the world, in every single country, so that we have a whole generation that runs towards the challenges instead of running away from them. And if anybody says it'll be impossible because cultures are too different, nations will never agree, values and virtues, the education of children is too sensitive, to those people, I would say, look, go take another look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Go take another look at the UN Charter. Those are two of the finest achievements of humanity, and they show when we really need to get our act together as a planet, we can do it. We've done it before. And interestingly, both of those documents were written in periods of great global stress, a little bit like 2020. So I think now is the time to do that again.
Yeah. And speaking of 2020, I can't believe we made it 23 minutes into this conversation without mentioning this, but COVID-19, it's been interesting to say the least. It's been catastrophic to some countries. I think it's been catastrophic to everyone's mental health, but nonetheless, how can, obviously the United Kingdom, it's approaching possibly what's going to be, is going to look like a second lockdown. The United States, if we were under a different administration, we would be in a second lockdown with the numbers that we had right now. What has the global response been, and what responsibility has America kind of held in the lack of a global response? And, you know, here on domestic politics, we blame China a lot. What, you know, can you offer perspective onto, did China do a good job? Is it really the United States messing up and we're just having this, like, we're the best, we can't do anything wrong perspective on it?
I think there's a grain of truth in all of those stories. None of them are entirely false. It certainly looks as if China waited a bit too long to respond, and that was part of the reason why the thing got out when it did. But this could so easily have happened at so many points in history in so many different countries. Right now, the blame game is not the most useful way of spending our time or energies. No doubt there will be a great deal of score settling afterwards. I think that China has made up for lost time admirably. I think it's worked very, very hard to try and sort out its own pandemic problem at home, and also to do what it can to try and stabilize things abroad. I think they messed up. Nothing like the way that the US administration has deliberately turned its face away from the problem and pretended that the problem doesn't exist, which is culpable. It's shocking. I would never have believed that it was possible to see a democratically elected administration in the Western world, let alone in the United States of America, just thoughtlessly allowing its citizens to die for political purposes. It's profoundly shocking. And whatever China may have done, and I don't believe the conspiracies about China deliberately creating or releasing the virus, that's just insane.
Yeah.
But whatever China has done, it's nowhere near as bad as what the USA has done. And the simple fact of the matter is that the United States is looked up to by every regime on earth. And what the US does grants some form of permission to other countries to do the same. Luckily, other countries are learning very quickly not to copy what America does, which is why so many other countries have handled the epidemic so much more effectively than the US has. But it breaks my heart to see the figures in the United States just going up and up and up and up. The US of all countries looking like it's the country that has probably suffered most harm unnecessarily from this contagion of all countries on earth. And what a turnaround.
Absolutely.
We just topped 100,000 cases a day in the United States, and it's just sheer ignorance. You talked about we continue to be ignorant. And I think that beyond even granting permission to other countries, we're granting permission to our own citizens to be ignorant in their efforts by having super spreader events run by our president, having things like that happen almost, you know, every single week. I want to drag in, though, one of our listeners on this episode today asked you a question, Simon. He's been waiting for a little bit. His name is Jack Elliott. He's one of our student classmates at our school that we go to, a high school junior. So I'm going to drag him in to talk to you a little bit about what he had to say.
Sure.
There we go. So Jack is on. Go ahead, Jack. So you are still muted. If you want to unmute yourself and talk to Simon. All right, there we go.
There you go.
All right.
I can hear you. Hi,
Jack. Hello. So it's so nice to meet you, Mr. Arnold. So I was born in the UK, and I lived there until I was 6. So I would like to know what the average British person thinks about the political situation in the US. Like, do they feel bad? Do they laugh at us? What's the mood over there on a more personal scale?
I can see the Union Jack on your
there
wall.
It is. There it is. Yeah,
a part of you is still attached. I think the single word is horror. I think that like so many other countries, we're used to looking up to the U.S. in many ways as a model modern country. It's a crazy place, and we love it because it's crazy, but not this kind of crazy. Not irresponsible crazy. And I think that what people are particularly horrified by at the moment is the spectacle of this election and the kind of talk that we're hearing at the moment about, for example, the president himself threatening not to accept the results of a democratic election, and talk of possible violence if the election goes badly, although the United States has a long and proud history of violence around elections, but still, you know, you don't expect to hear it today. So I think we're horrified and we're alarmed. And you've got to bear in mind that we're going through, as you very well know, our own little political crisis at the moment, which is Brexit. In many ways, Brexit is a far more serious problem than Donald Trump, because Donald Trump will be president for one term, perhaps possibly two terms. But in the end, countries can survive an ineffective government. We have taken ourselves out of the world's largest trading blocks voluntarily and decided to go it alone, which might have made sense in 1890, but it doesn't make any kind of sense in 2020 at all. And as I said on the morning when they announced the Brexit referendum, and it turned out that a slender majority of British people wanted to leave the European Union, I tweeted that morning, "My country has just shot itself." Whether it shot itself in the foot or shot itself in the head remains to be seen. And we still don't know, because actually the impact of Brexit really hasn't dawned on us. So the consequence of that is that you've got probably somewhat more than half the population at the moment already feeling extremely anxious about Britain's place in the world. What's going to happen when Brexit really starts to bite? Combined with the pandemic, are we even going to be able to put food on our tables? And the idea that that guarantor of global stability, the United States, is going through its own insane crisis, which is just as bad, if not worse, than our own, again, it contributes to that general sense. I don't know. It's as if we suddenly realized that the space that separated our orderly lives up until last year from total blank chaos was no thicker than a sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. We thought that this stable, prosperous, peaceful world that basically ticked over pretty well, bar a few wars here and there that we could deal with, we thought that was so solid. We thought that was the whole universe. And actually, we now discover that we were separated from complete chaos, just that much. And all it took was one major world leader deciding to do battle on truth and trust and a single pandemic, and everything has just been blown to smithereens, and we just have no idea what's going to happen next. It's really, really scary. So, Jack, the people in the UK are feeling the same way as people everywhere in the world at the moment. They're saying, you know, what the hell is going to come along next?
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you, Jack. We're going to drag you back into the waiting room.
Okay.
You got a lot of power here, Varun.
We do.
Got a lot of power
dragging people into our channel. But yeah, that is very, very impassioned. I want to drag in another one of our student guests who had a question for you. Nimish Kadam. He's another one of our juniors at our school, and he will be in it right now. Nimish, if you want to unmute yourself like Jack did and ask Simon your question, that'd be awesome. Yeah, I think you were good to go. There you go. I think he should be good. We cannot hear you, Nimish. Not yet.
If you want to type, actually, what he can do is he can type his question.
I think his question is typed up there. Yeah, we can ask his question.
Awesome.
Yeah. I wanted to make sure he can ask you, so I guess we can drag him back into there until he can get his audio working, give him a couple of minutes. But we can continue, Damien. You and I can.
Awesome.
All right.
I wanted to ask myself a question.
Go for it.
I do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Simon, what is the role played by kind of tribalism and factions in all of this? Because, you know, the conversation has been slightly skirting it, but at the base of all these issues we've been discussing is the question of this kind of pathological tribalism that seems to exist everywhere. And, you know, the fact that even the wearing of masks has become tribalized and politicized. Well, you know, Simon, that's a really interesting question, and I'm glad you asked it because I wanted to talk about this. I think one of the most dangerous ideas in the world at the moment is the idea that there's a tribe called localists, nationalists, and there's a tribe called globalists or internationalists, and they're enemies, and they should hate each other. And they should scream abuse at each other on social media from dawn till dusk. This is the most dangerous idea in the world, and it makes fools of all of us, because that localist or that globalist or that nationalist isn't a different tribe. It's just you on a different day. And if you stop and just think about it for 5 minutes, you realize that actually part of all of those attitudes in all of us. We can understand them well. It's just a question of proportion. I'm a globalist. I spend my whole day worrying about global issues, but I sure as hell care about the tiny village I live in. So I understand exactly what it means like to be a localist and to focus on that and say, no, that's the most important thing. In political terms, I don't know whether I'm left wing or right wing. I think it's all just a whole load of childish games. But I suppose that my ideas are somewhat more liberal progressive than they are conservative. But certain days of the week, I look at conservative values and I say, well, I understand that. I really understand it.
Yeah.
And we should all do this all the time and understand that these are not warring tribes. It's just you on a different day. And we have this terrible, terrible habit of tribalizing everything and turning it into a fight. And it's just not necessary. All of the projects I do, the first thing I ask myself about them is this going to make the gulf wider or is it going to bring people together? Because if people think that what I'm doing, say, with the Good Country Index is a backlash against the rising tide of nationalism, then it doesn't deserve to exist. I shouldn't be doing that because then I'm just guilty of more tribalism. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do is to bring people together. The people who vote for President Trump or the people who voted for Brexit, they're not mad or bad or stupid. They're just you on a different day.
Yeah.
Their priorities are slightly different because their circumstances are slightly different, or they've had a different life experience or what have you. And we've got to talk to them like they were us. Otherwise, we can't talk.
Well, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, interestingly enough, me and Varun do a lot of stuff with Politine, and the center of everything that we do is always, how is this going to spark conversation? How is this going to make a better community engagement? And we started Politine amongst other things because of the sense of hyper-partisanship, just like, you know, throughout the whole nation. And we realized that the issue at the core of it was the fact that we just can't talk with each other. You know, you can't walk into a barbershop and have a conversation with your barber about something political without, you know, feeling the tension in the room. Or you can't even have a conversation at dinner without, you know, voices being raised. So we realized that if we can come on here and, you know, the way that we explain it to everyone is we're just having a conversation. Cameras happen to be on now, but microphones happen to be on and be recording what we're saying. And I think that that's something that's really important for people to do. And that's what we try to inspire. We try to inspire people to have conversations, to ask questions, even if they might be somewhat uncomfortable, because at the end of the day, we all are just, you know, one another on a different day. And I love that perspective to it.
For you. And what's your explanation? I haven't been able to figure this out. Why has it got like this?
Why has it? Wow. That's, I think this is
like
one
it,
of the,
it wasn't like this.
I have an interesting answer. I think
Go
that
for
my
it.
Explanation is the fact that people have too many labels upon who a person is. For example, left wing, right wing, Democrat, Republican. I think the label should be American. And we had a guest on our podcast before, Matt Lieberman, who was the son.
Or even human.
Or even human, exactly. Yeah. And that creates a different perspective because think about it. We all have left wing kind of values, right wing values. Nobody's completely on a certain level, right? But the fact that we are associating ourselves with that side completely doesn't open up the idea of conversation. The idea of us going out and having these kinds of compromise and talks with the other party. It just does not give forth the idea that we are an American people, a human race, and we have common goals, common objectives. And I think that needs to be achieved. And the only way I see that we can achieve it is by dropping the label.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, the interesting thing is when we first started the podcast, obviously we stated, you know, our political views and Rune's more liberal, you know, speaking of labels, Rune's more liberal and I'm more centrist. And I always explain to, you know, my reasoning behind that is, you know, if you go on a date and someone asks you to say something about yourself, you shouldn't say that you're Republican or that you're Democrat when they're asking you to, you know, say something about yourself. So that's always been like a personal value of mine. And that's another thing with the podcast. So in a way, I agree with Varun, you know, absolutely. We just need to, you know, acknowledge that we all bleed red and that at the end of the day, we're all just trying to do what's best for each other. And we might have different approaches to that. But as long as we're not trying to hurt anyone else, I think that we're all trying to do some good.
I'm feeling happier now just after talking to you guys. Because I mean, if you're anything like, I mean, you're the same age as my kids.
Yeah.
My kids say pretty similar things. And this is one of the reasons why I'm stupidly optimistic at the moment. I know this is a time for all thinking people to be incredibly demoralized. Actually, I've never been so optimistic. I think this is a wonderful moment in human history. And it's people say to me, my God, this is the worst possible time to be bringing out the stuff that you're bringing out. Actually, it's the best possible time because people are shaken at the moment. And when people are shaken, they let go of their complacency and they let go of their prejudices even. And talking about the stuff that I'm talking about now 10 years ago was incredibly difficult because the more liberal leaning people were just so convinced nothing would ever come to challenge their worldview. And to get change was incredibly difficult. Today, you can produce change because everything is very precarious. People are doubting everything. Nobody's complacent. Everybody's anxious. And that's the right time to produce change. I have a little theory about why these labels have become so prevalent. People often say that this kind of intolerance is caused by ignorance. And it's true, there's a lot of ignorance there. But actually, I think it's more to do with laziness than anything else. It's so much easier to categorize people into lumps than it is to look at them individually. It's just less work.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I had a dollar for everybody who writes to me every day and says it's people like you who, you know, I would now have about $38. it's so much simpler just to say, yeah, it's because you're a Republican, or yeah, it's because you're an American, or yeah, it's because you're a man, or yeah, it's because whatever. Because that way you've dealt with thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people in one go, and you don't have to go to all the trouble of getting to know the individual. And so one of the things that we've got to teach kids in the future is there's no shortcut to being able to understand people. You have to understand them as individuals. And don't imagine that you can prejudge them on the basis of what they're wearing or what they look like or what party they vote for, because it's very misleading and it's just lazy.
I think we just solved the majority of world problems right here in this conversation. We got the end of racism. We've unified nations at this point. I think that we need to all go into the political advisement field after this.
Yeah. Well, look, this moment's going to define us, right? Like Simon Absolutely. Said, what we do in response to what's happening right now, COVID-19, racial tensions, the world economy, you know, tanking, this is what is going to define our generation and this generation for, I guess, years to come, centuries to come. I'm going to invite Nimish Kadam back on to kind of talk to you. Hopefully his audio is worked up. I think there was an issue with his audio. Nimish, can you hear us?
He's muted right now.
He is muted. So
there you go.
There you go. There you go.
Okay. So should I just go ahead and ask?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, introduce yourself.
So my name is Nimish. It's nice to meet you, Mr. Anholt.
Hi, Nimish.
So you were talking about China earlier and how other countries are like dependent on China for trade and stuff. So I was thinking, like, if China is using so China has been debt trapping countries, as you might know, but so would that be considered better on a global scale than U.S. isolationism? Because if China is using their trade to debt trap other countries, then it wouldn't have as much of a benefit, would it?
You know, thanks for the question, Nimish. The reality of the matter is that countries are never one thing. A country is a big and complex entity. And most countries do a certain amount of good and a certain amount of harm. And America is no exception, and China is no exception. America still does enormous amounts of good around the world. It still delivers enormous amounts of badly needed economic development and aid. It still helps out countries that are in trouble. China also does the same. China also delivers enormous amounts of valuable development work in Africa and in developing countries. It's a valuable participant in most of the international bodies. In fact, interestingly enough, every time the US government pulls out of an international institution, the Chinese will slip their own person in. I've noticed this pattern repeating itself over the last few years. And so I think it's probably not a great idea to try and summarize countries as if they were individual players performing individual actions. They're not even especially strategic countries. Even China, which is supposed to be somewhat more strategic than most in the sense that it has this fabled patience and this fabled long-term view, it moves around from year to year. It does different things in different circumstances. Sometimes it's offensive, sometimes it's defensive. Sometimes it's collaborative, sometimes it's competitive. And so I don't think that there's much to be gained by trying to summarize the overall character of a nation in that way. You can certainly do it with an individual administration. But here, if you look at the utterances of Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, it is really very confusing, because the way that he talks about, for example, trade, the way that he talks about the One Belt, One Road initiative in particular, he's talking a pure good country talk. He's talking about the harmonious rise of China. He's talking about the essential need for China to work with other countries along the Belt and Road initiative to lift them out of poverty, and the rising tide that benefits all ships. This is the kind of talk that we would want to hear from a leader. Yet, as we know, because it's on the media every single day, the treatment of minorities within the Chinese territory is profoundly shocking. And the saber rattling around the Pacific Rim and so forth. So what can we say? Countries are countries. They are complex and they play complex roles. And it's a game of three-dimensional chess, and it's very, very hard to summarize what's going on. One has to speak in terms of individual initiatives or individual sectors, I think. It wasn't a great answer to your question, Nimish.
No, that's good. You're fine.
Nimish,
I'm going to drag you back in the waiting room. Thank you so much for the question.
I wanted to say an interesting point that you brought up during that. Let me just turn you guys' cameras back on here for the podcast. An interesting point that you brought up during that, you know, during your answer was the Chinese treatment, you know, domestic treatment of individuals. And something that we mentioned on the podcast was the fact that the U.S. likes to get involved in things like this. Typically, the U.S. will always put, you know, it depends on what they have to gain from it, I think, sometimes, but they will put they'll definitely give their 2 cents when it comes to human rights. But I would say now, more so than ever, it is hypocritical for the United States to do that, especially with the crisis that we're having at the border. So on that point, have countries looked at this? Have countries, you know, seen the crisis on the border and almost seen it hypocritical for the United States to be talking about humanitarianism?
I mean, the irony has not been lost on the world's media and the world's commentators. And again, I think, you know, the only word that can really describe many people's view of what's going on in the United States is horror, because rightly or wrongly, many of us around the world still have this idea of America being a place of refuge for people from other countries. And a civilization that was built on diversity. The fact that it's now shutting its borders to people who simply want to rejoin their families, let alone come and work there, is profoundly shocking to people. And the visual symbolism of the wall or the fence is as powerful a negative symbol to those who disapprove of it as it is a powerful positive symbol to those who approve of it. You know, as many, many people have said before me, this is not a moment in history when we should be building walls. We should be building bridges.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
One thing that I did notice, and speaking of diversity and how it's been attacked in our country, on October 30th, which is the Spanish Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, President Trump declared the National Day of Remembrance for those killed by illegal aliens in our country. And many people saw it as xenophobic, especially because it was on this day that is supposed to be a celebration of those dead. So it is a far-reaching just thing that you said, especially because COVID-19, the pandemic, and the economic downturn affects minority communities more than ever. And I think that ideologically as well does have an impact. Now, one of the questions that we had in our guest channel, our questions channel, that one of our guests did not get to ask one of our listeners, was it was centered around the idea that competition in some circumstances builds better and more practical uses, right? With the space race, we had competition empowering innovation, competition empowering, you know, a race forward. So do you think that if we go towards global cooperation, we would lose that sense of benefits created by competition? Would those be negated? Or is the global cooperation benefits even greater than those created by competition? What is your take on this?
I'm glad you asked me that question. I think because I talk so much about the value of collaboration and cooperation, people do sometimes assume that I have a problem with competition. I don't. Competition is a very valuable instinct. It's an intrinsic component of human nature. I'm competitive. You're competitive. We We wouldn't be human without competition. And the competitive spirit has lifted billions of people out of poverty. It drives the economy. Whether that's a good thing or not is another question, but we won't go there right now. Competition, as I often say, only becomes a problem when it's the only altar at which we worship. And that has been the issue globally almost for the last 80 to 100 years. And that's one of the reasons why we're in the mess that we're in, because we worship competition at the exclusion of all others. And we assume that it's antithetical to collaboration, and it's not. This is the thing that so many governments and so many decision makers don't really appreciate. It is perfectly possible to compete and collaborate at the same time. And wisdom consists of the harmonious balance between those two instincts. Interestingly enough, this was something that industry recognized many decades ago. Way back in the 1970s, the Japanese automotive industry was talking about this new idea then called co-opetition, which is where the players within a given industry, the auto industry in this particular case, competed against each other, but also at certain levels collaborated so that they shaped their own industry and they made it a good place where they could then compete. And the same is still true today. I mean, pretty much any car that you buy today is going to have components manufactured by one of that car manufacturer's competitors. They share supply chains, they share materials. You push that too far and it becomes an illegal cartel, but the basic idea is very, very good. Competition and collaboration, if they're wisely mixed, can be an extremely powerful and productive mechanism. And my argument is not that we should try and eliminate competition, because we'd never do it and it would be disastrous if we did. My argument is that that experiment of co-opetition is about 30 years overdue in the public sector. And this is what governments need to understand how to practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those of our viewers that are just tuning in, we're here with Simon Anholt. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. And for those of you listening afterwards to the podcast itself, we use Anchor to upload all of our podcasts. And Anchor is the sponsor of this episode. So if you guys would want to go and check out Anchor, it's anchor.com. Be sure to go check that out. It makes uploading podcasts extremely easy. I think Varun can testify to that. It makes the process a lot easier for us. So if you guys are interested in anything like that, please be sure to go check it out. But on the same question, you brought in the Japanese automotive industry. I wanted to ask you about here in the United States, we've seen a sort of space race, but not between another country. We've seen private entities kind of having a space race with SpaceX, and I think Jeff Bezos was creating his own. So is that something along the similar lines, and what does that do for public relations? What does something or for I guess relations between countries, what does something like a space race here domestically do?
I think this is all harmless stuff. I think the fact that you've got different players competing within a given industry, the benefits of that kind of dynamic are very well understood. For decades, it's been the subject of papers in the Harvard Business Review and consultants offering expensive opinions on the matter. We know that the more you stimulate competition, I mean, America's economy is built on the notion of competition. It celebrates competition. And as I say, it is absolutely fine. And it helps to generate more prosperity inside countries and between countries. We've also been talking about feelings of competitiveness between countries, and that's when it starts getting a little bit more interesting and we get back to the tribalism debate. People often also assume that I'm somehow against patriotism, that I would like to see the end of the nation state. Well, no, not really. I mean, I think the nation state is a pretty primitive idea, but it's fine. It's relatively harmless. And I think patriotism is also relatively harmless. There's nothing wrong. Indeed, there's a lot that's right about loving your own country in the same way that loving your own town or your own village or the company that you work for is perfectly fine. It's a natural human instinct. It means you have a profound sense of belonging, which you appreciate. And that's great. It only starts becoming a problem when it starts getting mixed up with funny ideas about the reason why I love my country is because it's better than other people's countries. And that's when you start getting problems. It's completely unnecessary. But leaders always push it that way because they think it makes the love stronger. If you create a common enemy, the other, and you say, the reason why we love our country is because we're going to defeat that character over there, And by the way, we're going to defeat that character over there if we're stronger than that character over there. And we know that we're superior. And then suddenly you've gone from benign patriotism to malignant nationalism. And that's when all the problems start. So ultimately, what we would really hope, I suppose, is that one day people might feel slightly more loyalty to the human race than to their own nation state. The problem is that the human race doesn't have any enemies that it knows of. There's only really one moment in anybody's life where they actually feel what it feels like to be rooting for the human beings. And that's when they go to the cinema and they watch Independence Day. Yeah. And you see those horrible kind of slimy aliens and you say, yay, the humans. And there's a moment when you walk out of the cinema blinking in the afternoon sunlight and you say, yeah, we're humans. Then it's gone. It lasts about 5 minutes and it's gone. And
yeah,
it's one of the tragedies of the age that we live in that somehow climate change is our common enemy. Never quite looked like a slimy alien. And nobody ever really perceived it as being the common enemy of humanity. The pandemic, on the other hand, is kind of more like a slimy alien. And that's why that's one of the reasons why, paradoxically, and this may seem like in rather poor taste, but bear with me, I think the pandemic has actually been extremely useful, because it has proved to all of us in the most dramatic possible way that we truly are one species. The pandemic doesn't distinguish between, it doesn't know what passport you've got in your pocket. It doesn't care what you've got in your pocket. It wants your insides. And
yeah,
I think that that has been very powerful. Everybody all over the planet, every night, if they've got a TV, they turn it on and they see other human beings suffering in the same way, hoping in the same way, fearing in the same way. And it's a common enemy that makes us realize that we're all human. And that's been incredibly valuable. And I think it will help in the fight against climate change once the pandemic is over.
Yeah, before I bring on our next student listener, I wanted to say that I'm big on climate change, the environment. I'm a big environmentalist. And I think that one of the reasons for why people don't give climate change enough credit, don't see it as that slimy creature that it actually is the fact that administrations like George W. Bush's administration went back and they created the term climate change instead of like global warming, for example, coined that term to make the image of what it is seem much less threatening than it actually is. And many people say we have time. We really do not have time to solve this crisis. We, as the next generation, know more than anybody. We have personal equity, a stake in it. And I think that we have to get solving right now. I think global leadership from the United States will take us there. Global leadership from countries across the world will take us there. But I think that it begins with us recognizing the really brevity of what we have right now. You talked about patriotic duties. And I think that in any country, regardless of what it is, I think that anybody's patriotic duty as a citizen is to constantly question, criticize, and strive for the better. I don't think it is just sitting back and saying, my country is the best, because we know there's always room for improvement. There's always room for helping out the world. And I think that constant motivation to become better is what makes countries great and what makes citizens. I think that's the basis of what nationalism should be about. I do want to bring on Julia Hartman, though. She's going to talk about the COVID-19 response and how people have politicized the issue in the United States. So Julie's another high school junior. She will come on. Julie, we have you on right now. If you can unmute yourself and talk to Simon, introduce yourself. Julia, you are still muted.
I wonder if there's a... There you go.
We got
you. Hi, Julia.
Let's see. Julia, can you hear us? Hold on. Maybe if we drag her back in and out.
I can hear her.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
really? Okay. I can't hear her. That's my bad. Sorry.
Lagging a little bit, but
yeah, I'm good.
I don't know if they said, but okay. Oh yeah, so I'm the head researcher for Polititeen, so, and it's really been fascinating to listen to conversation so far.
Julia, I think he can't hear you.
Yeah,
we're having some technical difficulties. Yeah, we can get this resolved. Damien, let me know when you have.
Yes.
Okay. Can we hear each other now?
Yeah. Can y'all hear me?
You're back, Julia.
Okay. Awesome.
Okay. So it's good.
Yep.
You're good.
Okay. Yep. All right. So I was just saying, you know, I'm the head researcher for Polititeen, and I'm personally really interested in possibly studying international relations. So it's been really fascinating to listen to this conversation so far. And my question really was going back to the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen it, especially in the US, being made into a political issue, especially with masks, where you have people in school like, I mean, even with their own president saying masks don't work, it's false, and you have this huge divide with something that in my opinion, it should just be obvious, you know, wear a mask, it helps others, the science is clear. Has this been seen in any other country in your experience with masks being made into such like a political issue? Have you seen that?
Yeah, it's appearing in one or two places. It was interesting, there was actually a march in London a few days ago of people who were rebelling against lockdown and rebelling against wearing masks. And the anger that was directed against them on social media was just overwhelming. People were just saying over and over and over again, look at all the problems that we're facing today, the real problems. And you people are out there marching because you want the right to infect other people with your virus? I mean, come on. So yes, unfortunately, it looks rather as if we've taken our lead from the US, which is what we always do, and we copied that particular. Maybe I shouldn't blame the US for it. Maybe we invented that ourselves. I just don't know. It is generally less common. It's not so pronounced. It's not so divisive, and it's not so energetic as it is in the US. And the impression that we get watching the media from outside the US is that you've got pretty much half the population in the USA refusing to wear masks and deliberately clustering together as if to defy the virus. I'm sure it's nothing like that, but that's the impression that we get. But I wanted to go back to something that you said, Julia, and also Varun said it in his earlier comment about the role and the responsibility of government in setting these rules for behavior. I think there has to come a stage where we stop blaming the government for everything that's wrong with society. We stop looking to government to make society right again. Because it's nothing to do with whether they're left-wing or right-wing. It's nothing to do with whether they're Trump or Obama. Successive governments in many, many countries around the world have proved conclusively over and over and over again that they are just regular human beings. They are not infallible, and we cannot rely on them to solve even domestic problems, let alone global problems. So enough already. Stop just endlessly repeating, it's the government, they didn't do this, they did that, it's their fault. Stop behaving like kids who blame everything on their parents. There comes a time when you have to grow up and say, you know what, it's up to me. Because I can see what they did wrong, I can see what they didn't do, so I know what should be done, I'm going to do it myself. I'm not saying revolution, obviously. I'm just saying I think we've now reached a stage in human history where the absolute utility of traditional governments is becoming thinner and thinner and thinner. And the reality of politics today is that I don't think we can afford pass all of those choices to this bunch of people who may or may not be any good. We have to participate in the way that our societies are managed. Politics has to become a collective endeavor. We all have to participate as you guys are doing. You're doing the right thing. The way that our societies are run and managed is everybody's responsibility. We no longer have anywhere in the world a political class that can be trusted to do that for us. And in a way, that's good. Just say, fuck them, you know?
Yeah.
It's our turn now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for the question, Julia. I'm going to drive you back in the waiting room.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that
Is that naughty of me to use that word?
No.
You're fine. We'll edit it out.
You're fine.
We have editing power, so you're
good.
I think that it's time, you know, time to put on our big boy pants and consider the issues we have in our country and actually resolve them as a people. I think that I thought we would be here by now. But the real bleak reality of what we're facing right now is that, as you said, a lot of people don't want to wear masks no matter where they are. So I think it's the immaturity of the human race in some circumstances. And even in the USA, I mean, it is the herd mentality approach, right? Because at a Trump rally, I think that a lot of people would actually believe in what COVID-19 is, do actually believe in the threats of COVID-19, the reality of what we're in right now. But because of that herd mentality, that tribalism, the blind tribalism, I think that they're coming into this kind of, they forget what is true and what they know to be true just to appease that kind of, what they believe to be the majority. I think a lot of people do consider the facts. They just are succumbed to that premonition.
Absolutely.
I think there's one tiny, tiny, tiny ingredient missing here. And that is the faculty of critical thinking.
Yeah.
That somehow or other, the people at those rallies should have, there should be a little Jiminy Cricket somewhere in their head that says, hold on, is this right? And that's called critical thinking.
Yeah.
And that's one of the most important roles of education. It teaches you to question, and it teaches you to stand on your own and just say, just because everybody else is doing this doesn't mean it's right. We have a little think here. So the role of education in many ways is really, really very simple. We don't have to teach people every single detail of daily life. We don't have to take kids at six and say to them, by the way, if COVID-19 should come back as COVID-37 when you're an adult, you've got to wear a mask, because that's not how you teach people. All you have to do is to teach them critical thinking, so that if they ever find themselves in any situation whatsoever, there's the risk of them behaving in a dumb way just because everybody else is behaving in a dumb way, a little light goes on in their head and says, hold on, think about that.
Yeah,
absolutely. And now, before we move on to our final question, Damien, I wanted to kind of bring this in. The fact that in East Asian countries, we're seeing very low numbers of COVID-19 now. China almost eradicated COVID-19 in certain cities because they have the culture of wearing masks. I think that to an extent, humans are also creatures of habit. And I think that because the places like Japan, China, places like that, Wuhan, have been wearing masks, if, for example, they get a cold or a cough in their past, they become these creatures of habit to where now with COVID-19, there's a consensus in their nations for the most part about mask wearing. So it's also a consequence.
There's another reason for that. And that is because those East Asian cultures, generally speaking, are what cultural anthropologists call collectivist. And they're brought up with a sense of responsibility to society.
Yeah.
Feeling that you are one unit in a group, and your duties to that group are as important to your duties towards yourself. The United States is what would be called an individualist society. Right? United States culture is based on the idea that it's about self-realization, self-actuation, self-discovery, and self-aggrandization. There's nothing innately wrong with it, but the danger of it is that when you want people to behave in a way that is for the collective good, it's very hard to get them to do that. It's like herding cats.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you wanted to be cynical about this, you could say the other reason why so many people do what they're told in East Asia is because they have a culture of obedience. And we wouldn't want America to turn into one of those, would we? I mean, one of the reasons why China has been so effective at suppressing the virus within its own borders is because it's an authoritarian state. And it's a relatively simple matter for President Xi to say, lock down that city, and it happens. Glorious freedom in America means you can say it as many times as you like, and it may even be true, and it may even be logical, and it may even be self-preservation, but you're still going to find a lot of people who refuse just out of cussedness. So those are the extremes. In the end, it's the individual who has to develop the faculty of critical thinking so that they say just logically what's the right thing to do here.
Yeah, absolutely. With that freedom comes a lot of responsibility, and we have to, I think, all start thinking a little bit more critically. But ladies and gentlemen, for those of you listening to the episode in post, tuning in on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you're listening to this, we want to thank you for tuning in to an amazing episode. Simon, thank you for joining us.
We have our last question, David.
Oh, yes. Yeah. This is the final question. This is what we ask every single one of our guests. If you had one message, one quote, one saying, one thing that you could leave to America's youth or to the youth globally here, what would it be? Take your time with it. We've had 5-minute segments where,
question.
Yeah, we,
yeah.
Oh, it's so difficult. there are so many things I would want to say. One of them I already said, and I would like permission to repeat that.
Absolutely.
Which is, this is not flattery. You are the best generation we've ever had. And a lot of us are pinning our hopes on you. With that comes enormous power and enormous responsibility. I don't want to increase the sensation that I know that people of your age feel already at the moment, that all the world's problems are sitting on your shoulders, even though you didn't create them. But they are.
Yeah.
And moving forward, if you can keep your critical faculties alive, if you can remember that first and foremost you're human beings, then American, and then Republican or whatever it is, then that's the right order.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the most important thing of all is to carry on doing what you're already doing, you guys, and to spread it, which is to avoid the laziness of generalizing about people. Always particularize. always remember that the individual in front of you is not the same as the group that you perceive them to belong to.
Yeah.
Take the trouble to understand where people are coming from individually, and then you won't go wrong.
Well, thank you so much, Simon. It's our first international guest on Politine, so it's an amazing episode for you guys. We hope you enjoyed it. Before Damien goes on, I just want to say a word of advice to all of our teens, our listeners today. Go out, have conversations, and as you have them, look into the unique and just the collective vision of Americans, the collective vision of humans. All of us have very collective goals. We have things that we have in common. Find those commonalities, push them, and create compromise. It's election day. Enjoy yourselves, and we'll come back to, I guess, 3 o'clock, 3:30 is our next segment with Angelica Couch. So Damien, if you want to
Yeah,
continue.
Absolutely. So for those of you listening to this in the post podcast, we want to thank you for tuning in. Varun, I want to thank you for, as always, asking inspiring questions, provoking conversation, listening to different perspectives. Simon, I want to thank you for your amazing take. I hope that we can have you on in the future as well. And, you know, if you want to hop on later today, you got nothing to do near election time, you know, feel free. We'll be here live streaming. But for those of you listening, thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Politine. As Varun said, go out and have your conversations. Go check out our website, Politine Podcast. Well, now it's actually just politine.com. Check out our social medias. Both Twitter and Instagram are at Politine Show. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. Goodbye.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politine Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/politinepodcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/politinepodcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/politinepodcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politinepodcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politine. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation. My friend, I do appreciate your input as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.